Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Rural Press Club of Victoria webinar, Water Unplugged, Lifting the Lid on Australia's Water Market, with our guest panel of water experts. My name is James Wagstaff, and I'm the Press Club President. Firstly, we welcome our panel, Jeff Akers, Craig Reynolds, Chris Olsak, and Peter Lawford, and thank them for taking time out to be with us today. I'd also like to recognise our sponsors, Telstra, Agriculture Victoria, Marcus Oldham College, the Transport Accident Commission, the CFA, Curry Communications, the Victorian Farmers Federation, Dock and Land, and the Weekly Times for their ongoing support of the club. I'd also like to thank all members of the Rural Press Club Committee for the work they do and their efforts in helping organise today's webinar. We've had a huge response with more than 400 registrations. The club has a number of webinars in the works for the coming months as COVID-19 still restricts our ability to host lunches and networking opportunities. The club's annual Journalism and Photography Awards will be presented in a virtual forum next month. So to all the journalists tuned in, reminder to get your entries in by the end of next week. We're also on the hunt for award sponsors. So if your organisation would like to support rural and regional journalism in what has been a pretty tough year for the sector, please get in touch. But back to today, the format will see a panel discussion for about 25 minutes, followed by 20 minutes of question and answers. Questions can be submitted through the Q&A link at the bottom of your screens, and as per Press Club rules, priority will be given to those from members of the media. With your questions, please state your name and organisation. I'd now like to introduce our facilitator for today's webinar, one of Australia's top rural journalists, ABC Rural's Kath Sullivan. Please welcome Kath to kick things off.
Thank you very much, Waggy. I think you calling me a facilitator is perhaps the nicest thing you've ever said about me. So very much appreciated, and thanks to the Rural Press Club for inviting me to be a part of this event today at a time when there's so much going on in the Murray-Darling Basin. There's a lot of complexities and that plays out in a lot of different ways. But today is essentially about how farmers can best use the water market to help them on farm. We're going to cut the crap. There's no politics. There's no policy. We want to know how things can be improved throughout the Southern Murray-Darling Basin. We'll be having a look at ways to navigate the complexity of the market, how to use the system to farmers' advantages, and perhaps touch on some of the issues around trust and transparency. We've got a fantastic panel today, which is, I guess, made up of two halves. There's the farmers, who I like to think of as the real people. Jeff Akers, a dairy farmer at Tallygarutna in northern Victoria with more than 30 years experience in, I'm not sure if it's 30 years. I've got my wires crossed there. That's Craig Reynolds, who's got 30 years on the clock as an irrigated cropper. He's the chair of the Shepherd and Water Service Committee of Goulburn Murray Water, and he's a director of Irrigated Cropping Council, joining Jeff Akers, who is a former chair of Dairy Australia. The other half of our panel is made up of Peter Lawford, who's chief executive at Waterpool. Now, Peter is in charge of the not-for-profit water trading entity, vast knowledge and experience in trading in both the corporate and irrigator level, joining us from Rochi in northern Victoria today. And Chris Olsak, who's the founding director of AIFA, who a lot of people will be familiar with AIFA and its reports across policy, market and infrastructure. Chris works a lot with governments and utilities and has had a lot of input on some of those reports that our politicians refer to regularly. So looking forward to his input. We've got a very tight program, so let's get into it before we can get to your questions. Beginning with Jeff and Craig, having a look at some of the challenges that farmers face with the water market today. And Craig, something that you've told me about, which I think is a great starting point, is when you spend a dollar on your farm, you hope to get $2 back. Now, how on earth can you do that with the water market that we've seen over the past little while?
It simply comes down to just knowing what your costs are and what you can make out of the water, how much grain I can grow with a megalitre of water. Like at the moment, I'm doing the maths on irrigating, say, canola. I think I can get a tonne per megalitre. And a ton of canola is worth, $500 plus. So, you know, that'd be the return I'm looking. I've already sunk all my costs in the winter crops. So I would simply just, that's the type of simple maths that I do for when it comes to using water.
So you make it sound really simple, but can you see how some farmers struggle to manage the influx in the market?
Yeah, and if everyone does the same thing, the water market would go up to $500 and there'd be no profit left. But we set up our business to do that 15 years ago. We know that there's times like last year where we can use very little water and we have to do other things to, achieve the best yield out of the crop. So we know that that can happen. But out of the last 10 years, there's only been 1 year we've been a seller. And I think we're doing okay.
Sorry, that's only 1 year where you've had one out of the box?
Well, where we could achieve a higher price out of the water market than we could out of growing crops.
How do you find the availability of water affects your decision making?
Water's pretty widely traded now. There's quite a established market, and really you can buy water anytime you like, really. It's just you got to have the funds available to pay for it.
Now, Craig, as a cropper, I think Jeff has perhaps looked at your enterprise with a little bit of envy as a dairy farmer, saying that perhaps the cropping sector is a little bit more accustomed to managing water like other commodities. I'll go to Jeff for his take on that in a moment, but do you think it's easier given that you are perhaps used to doing that?
And when I first started in agriculture, that was the thing I found the hardest was the marketing of grains and hay. You've got to know where the prices are, you've got to know where your costs are, and that's just translated across into the water market. It's just like any other market, as I can see.
What do you make of that, Jeff?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the issue for me has been, I don't claim to be an expert, but someone that tries to fumble their way around the water market and make a profit growing grass for cows, I guess. And I mean, like Craig, there's only been one season where we've found that probably we should have sold water rather than use it, and that was the year gone by. We've never been in the temporary market as a seller, just a buyer. And I mean, that's been the challenge for, I think, a lot of dairy farmers, is that we're not commodity traders on a regular basis, and the grains industry, as Craig said, have been doing it for a long time. They buy and sell a lot of commodities into their business all the time. So understand about trading a commodity like water. And it's not about I suspect it needn't be about maximizing the profit all the time on it. It's about understanding when you're going to make a profit on the water. And it may be for today, or it may be in 6 months' time, that they should be strategic decisions about when we enter the market. So if water's at $200, well, what's got to be for me to make a profit at $200? So if it's at $200 and I know I have to buy 800 for the year, should I be buying some of it now? Instead of taking the risk and buying it when I need it. And that's, I guess, what we haven't been used to doing as dairy farmers on a regular basis, across a whole lot of other inputs into our businesses.
I was going to say, how do you do that when you've got cows that need feeding?
Yeah, well, I mean, everybody's business is going to be different. And I mean, so that's why you've got to look at your own. And, we've got a mix of high reliability water that we have in our business. It's been below 50%, and we've tried to move that up to above 50% of the high reliability water that we need for our business. We use carryover, so we always... So in rough terms, we've been below, but we're about 50-50. We carry over about 25% of our needs, and then we're in the market that year for about another 25% of the needs for the business, and that's just how we've operated it. And for an expansion of the business, I think I've now got to move up that high reliability water to take the risk out of it, to then be able to grow to the next level and stage. So we'd be looking to increase the high reliability, because it takes a certain amount of risk out and cost. Because with a dairy cow, a cropper can choose not to grow the crop this year. We've still got to find some way to feed the cow. Now, whether it's from pasture, which we've tended to do pretty well every year other than last year, but she's still got to be fed something at a cost that we can still get a return on from the milk price we get.
And Craig, I might bring you in here at this point to hear Jeff talk about a switch to high reliability. Do you think that's something we'll see more dairy farmers doing, and how is that likely to affect price and supply?
Well, I think that that would be one way of managing it.
I'm still happy to have a mix, but I mean, as I said, I think we need at least 50% of ownership of that high reliability to secure my business.
For me, like, we've actually sold some of our high reliability water because we thought we could do better things with the money. I did the sums at the time, and interest rates were 8% then, and, you know, a $2,000 megalitre of water was costing me $160 every year in opportunity costs and interest and other things. So I sort of chose to sell some high security water and use the money elsewhere in the business. And any time that water's under $160, but now interest rates are lower, so that changes the and interest rates are very low at the moment. So high reliability water.
Should ask some of our real experts what the value of water is going to do, then I'd know how much I'd buy, because it's probably not the best decision now that we've, with those of us that have sold some, that, it's more than doubled in value in 2 years or something.
Well, I think that's a really good point, Jeff, is we have a bit of trouble looking into the crystal ball, don't we, when it comes to the price of water. Chris, what's your take on where the market's at and just how far it can go?
Yeah, so look, I think we have been commenting for over the last 5 years or more that there's some fundamental changes in supply and demand that are going on across the market that have all pointed towards increasing prices. We've seen entitlement prices skyrocket over the last 5 or 6 years. You know, some have more than tripled in value in that time. Some of the drivers from the allocation market perspective in relation really come down to supply and demand and the market working. From a supply perspective, the biggest factor has just been rainfall and climate, as we were talking about before we started. Inflows into the Murray system have dropped 50% when you compare the last 20 years to the 120 years beforehand. So it's a dramatic shift and reduction in supply. Of course, you're going to get your wet years and your dry years, but we've seen this pretty significant change that people are trying to get to grips with. And then on top of that, we've had water recovery initiatives through the government buyback that have reduced the amount of entitlement or allocation available for the irrigation consumptive pool. And we've had massive demand changes as well. Irrigators across the board have... there's a lot of talk about the impact of almonds and horticultural development, and they're definitely a driver of increased prices. But across the board, irrigation businesses have got more competitive, more efficient. They've invested in water use efficiency. There's also been other things like cotton coming in that have made big impact on the prices.
So how do you manage that? If you can't control what those are doing upstream or downstream, if you can't control what's coming out of the sky, what are the things that you can do on your farm to make the most of the market?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it comes down to what Craig and Jeff were talking about, is from an internal perspective, knowing your business and understanding your numbers and what makes your business tick, and then keeping an eye on what's happening externally, what's happening in other commodities, what's happening with the climate, and making good decisions. And there's a number of elements of making those good decisions that are going to work for your business in the short term and the long term. Managing risk so you don't, get too far ahead of yourself, or you don't expose yourself too much if things turn against you. And there is a whole lot of uncertainty around how conditions, commodity markets are going to play out. And water's no different from a whole bunch of other factors.
Is water different to other commodity markets?
Well, in a lot of ways, it's the same. It's highly variable. I guess that's the main thing. And it's because we live in the most variable continent in terms of rainfall and water supply. So that's the main difference.
I see Peter Lawford having a cough there. Is this your key?
That was a clear of the throat rather than an objection. I totally support what Chris just said in terms of the climate is the biggest driver of where we finish up with price outcomes. And the recent rains are evidence of that. There's an easing in prices at the moment to some degree in the allocation market. And permanent stuff is on the decline slightly at the moment too. So back to some more perhaps realistic values. But our two farmer gentlemen, the better people in the room, as you discussed earlier.
No, I said more normal, not better.
Oh, well, the normal people, sorry. But, you know, balanced portfolio is the key to security to some degree. If you can up your high reliability, certainly that's a lot of security, but there's a number of other products that can provide alternative solutions to that on-farm planning of water use. And, lease has become incredibly popular in the last few years.
Explain how that works?
So it's literally, a farmer leasing water rather than owning the water. So you're basically leasing permanent entitlement and getting the benefits of that permanent entitlement in terms of allocation. There are a number of private irrigators or retired farmers that will provide water that they've kept as an investment opportunity. They'll provide the market with lease in that space, and a number of investors also supply a lease product.
So that's an opportunity if you can't afford to get more high reliability water, as Jeff was suggesting his business is approaching. That's another way.
Yeah, look, it's a means to an end. Generally, you're looking at around about a 6% cost on the price of permanent entitlement is the rule of thumb. But the other tools like forward allocation and carryover, as Jeff suggested, can also help make up a portfolio without that huge outlay initially around permanent entitlement.
Now, Peter, the Rural Press Club has selected this panel today as a group of experts, but there is so much information and expertise about the water market. There's also a heap of crap which people need to wade through at the same time. How do you tell the farmers that you're dealing with, and I know you deal with corporates as well, how do you sort the wheat from the chaff?
Look, it's not easy. There's so many different sources of information, and you're quite right. We rely, our information stems from partly from our own trading, of course, but in Victoria specifically, the Victorian Water Register is a really, really good resource of information. It's world's best practice in terms of that registration process and recording process. And if we can get a little bit more clarity around trade types in allocation and maybe split allocation off from the permanent trades, we'll get some more accurate market figures in that space as well. And that's apparently a work in progress, which will be fantastic.
Craig, I might bring you back into the conversation here. As a farmer, where do you find you get the information that you need, and how do you sort what you need from what you don't need?
Well, most of the time I have relationships with a few brokers, and I'll have a ring around if that's where I'm at, and pretty constantly checking the weather and the water markets. So most farmers check the weather multiple times a day. Well, we probably do similar with the water markets. Keep an eye on that. We need to know where the price is. And that's something I think most farmers, irrigation farmers, do these days. If you've got a room of irrigation farmers together, they'd nearly all tell you what the price was within a few dollars most of the time, is my experience. So I think that information is readily available. It's crystal ball gazing though to, what's going to happen with the price.
Yeah. Where is the price, Craig? We'll do a little test.
It's just over $200 at the moment, somewhere between around that $210 to $230 from in the Goulburn, and about $350 in Zone 7 in the Murray.
Okay, so I've certainly seen it a lot worse.
Yeah, well, it depends whether you're a seller or a buyer, doesn't it?
Very good point. Jeff, do you have anything to add to that on what information... where you get access to?
I think it's been one of the most challenging things for our business. And I mean, I think everybody needs to develop a trusted pool of people they get their information from. And I think historically, this has been a real problem for farmers. They've got their information from sources that aren't that great. And we've seen people get into strife. That's all I'd say simply. So, I mean, I always enjoy getting information from the other three people on this panel, for example. An independent person, someone with some skin in the game, and another farmer that always has a view. So I don't always agree with them, but you need to take the information from them and see whether it makes sense. And as Craig said, I mean, brokers are an interesting crowd. I think it's important that you have a relationship with at least two or three, maybe more.
This sounds like a bit of life advice, Jeff.
They're worse than second-hand car salesmen, and so you can't put all your trust in one of them. But you've got to hear what they're all saying, and they never give you a straight answer, I guess, is what I'd say. But if you put it all together when you do your ring around, you'll finish up. It'll generally be fairly consistent. But I mean, it's one of those things. I think it's a really important part of most of our businesses, and you need to develop some relationships, and they need to be trusted relationships with people that you're sure understand the industry. And there's plenty of people giving a lot of advice in this space out there that really they've been wrong. And you need to, keep testing the water and find a group of people. So once again, I say it's not one person you get all your advice from. It has to be a couple. And when you're making your decisions, the advice has to add up because, it's one of the most changing parts of any of our businesses that are out there. And I mean, if we look at the change in value of water in the different systems within the basin at the moment, it's very significant. The rules are changing all the time, and we need to be across those rule change on a monthly basis, Nelly, to understand the value of what's going to happen with our temporary water and our permanent water.
I'm getting a lot of nods from our panel there, Jeff, and also a lot of questions are starting to come through, so we'll get to those. But I do feel like, Peter Lawford, we might need to give you a right of apply.
Look, I'm pretty good at selling cars. No, not really. I mean, the industry is, I think it's fair to say, trading industry is under review from the ACCC at the moment, and I think we all look forward to what the outcomes of that might be. And I certainly agree with Jeff in terms of sourcing his information from different spaces. Not all people in the broking industry are used car salesmen. There's some genuine, decent people in the industry. And so I will push back on that one just a little, Jeffrey. But importantly, I think that broker behaviour needs to be careful that we're not driving the market one way or the other. I think it's vitally important that we provide a business facility where traders set the price. Climate will drive the price, supply will drive the price, but we shouldn't have a space in suggesting price. We let our traders nominate their prices on both sides, whether they're buyers and sellers, and let the market make its own decisions.
It certainly has been interesting, and you do hear some horror stories about cowboy traders and the level of regulation that we have in the water market. And I dare say that'll be a consideration of the ACCC's report, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, of course, looking at the water market. This was a pre-election commitment from the government. We know that Nick Keogh's been on the task for a little while now, and that the government does have the interim report. We're just waiting for the Treasurer to make that public, but what with the biggest deficit since World War II, it seems like he's got a bit on his plate. Chris, I might bring you in here. Do you have any concerns about how this report into the ACCC, this is actually a question from Clint Jasper of the ABC, wondering how you think this report might affect the administration of the market?
Look, I think everyone's waiting to hear what the ACCC has to say. They've been at work for almost a year with their interim report. They've had a pretty comprehensive look at the governance and management of the market by governments. I think they've had a pretty strong look at brokers, as Peter was looking at explaining, and they've had a pretty strong look at the conduct of market participants. So I think we all need to wait and see what they say before we kind of hypothesize on what that might be. But, you know, they could raise some pretty important issues around whether the market is working in a fit for purpose way. But the one thing I would say is my view is that, whatever they say is probably not going to change the prices all that much in the allocation market. Our view has always been that it is the fundamentals of supply and demand that are really driving the allocation prices.
Would you like to add to that, Peter or Craig?
I think Chris is right. It's a supply and demand scenario. The market seems to work well when prices are reasonable, and it seems to fall under a level of criticism when prices are high. And that's an emotional drive rather than a practical drive sometimes. But I think it's important that, you know, we understand it is supply and demand, and as long as the market facilitates that in a fair way, I don't think we're far off the mark at the moment. But, you know, there'll be some changes around the edges at least to come out of these reports, I think, and any change for the better is always going to help the irrigator at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's interesting how emotional all of this conversation around water can get. Now, Natalie Kotsias, who's a reporter with the Weekly Times, I think she's trying to stir the pot a little bit here. She's asking about the way that water is increasingly going to the highest value market. She wonders, to stop that happening would be possibly one way of telling farmers what they can and can't grow. Is it time we had a serious discussion about what and how much crops and commodities are grown and where? And I might start with you, Jeff. How do you fancy the idea of someone telling you what you can and can't do with your water?
I don't really support it. I went to school when, you know, the free market was the thing, and that's what we had banged into us right through senior school and early college, I guess. But we've been in a market now where, you know, it's 15 years ago now, I guess, where we were told that water would trade to its highest value, and highest value agriculture would finish up with the water. And we probably in the dairy industry are a little asleep at the wheel on this one, because we thought we were going to be right. We were about the highest value. Horticulture only used about 10% of the water, and next was dairy. And to be honest, I think for 7 or 8, nearly 10 years, the industry was asleep. Thought we'd be right and there'd be plenty of water for dairy. And we've had a whole lot of climatic changes and less water, and other agricultural industries have adjusted better. And probably as an industry, we're now paying the price, probably for that attitude. So, I mean, I think we've got to be prepared to do that. I mean, I don't think there's much other way. I mean, there's a whole lot of rules and that sort of stuff that we may not have supported, but that's one that's been there now for a long time, and we've just got to adjust to it, I think.
And hope that the milk price comes up.
Yeah, well, or our practices, you know, it's about costs, and that's right. And it's about putting a system in place that allows you to grow a crop that returns you a profit.
Peter Lawford, how often are you dealing with punters who come to you and who want to blame those downstream for taking a bigger piece of the pie than what we've been used to previously?
It's a regular conversation. Sometimes there's a bit of a divide between certain commodity groups. It's something we do learn, and we deal with all these guys. What we do learn, at the end of the day, everyone's in the same boat. Yes, some commodities can afford to pay a little bit more, but their security issues are the same as anybody's security issues. So it's important, I think, that we need to respect those industries, because the sunk costs in the higher value use crops are sometimes much larger than the lesser value crops as well. So I think we need to look at the industry more holistically than just, you know, blaming someone that can afford to pay a bit more for water for driving the price. I mean, obviously, if you're in a high value use crop, the less you pay for your water, the more profit you're going to make. So it's not actually a driver of it. It facilitates it.
And speaking about blaming others based on their commodity, there's a fair bit of blame based on location in the Murray-Darling Basin getting around as well. And Natalie Kotsis actually has another question here about the role of the states in managing this resource. And she's posing the question if it's perhaps time that the management of the basin was just handed over to one single entity or one authority. As an irrigator, Craig Reynolds, does that idea appeal to you?
Not particularly. you would like to see a bit more consistency across the basin, you know, like even just water, we have to have water on our account, and then in others, there's other places in the basin where you can replace the water 3 months later, you know, after you've used it. So, you know, I'd like to see a bit more consistency, but I'm not 100% convinced that that would be a great thing.
Chris, would you care to have a crack at that one?
Well, the states have been managing water for a very long time, over 100 years. So, yeah, I think you'd need to have a pretty good case for changing it. But what we have said and commented through the market is that we need to view it as a connected system. What's happening in the Murrumbidgee has an impact on what's happening for Craig and for Jeff in the Goulburn. So it is a connected system. So as Craig said, it's about having the consistency in the way that rules are applied, making sure government is taking a bigger picture look to the way the market works and the way participants within the market are behaving. But I think that can be done without turning the whole thing on its head and taking it away from the states.
Now, Chris, a question's come through for you from Jeff at the Country News, saying, is climate the only main driver for price? Environmental water now accounts for hundreds of gigalitres. Hasn't that affected supply and hence the price?
Absolutely, and I did say that the recovery of water for the environment by the government has reduced the consumptive pool by 20 to 30% in the Southern Murray-Darling Basin, and to us and through all the modelling work that we've done, has a material impact on allocation prices. And on top of that, obviously climate varies the price significantly from year to year. And the other big factor over the last 5 or so years has been the changes on the demand side that we mentioned, horticultural development and just these broader trends towards more efficiency and productivity across all of the irrigation sectors.
Now we're getting right down into the weeds. I've got a pretty technical question directed at you, Jeff. This comes from Andrew Miller at the Stock and Land. What's your understanding about the return to irrigators' share of the 75 gigalitres of water saved under stage one of the Connections project? Will it be returned as high reliability or term average equivalent? Can you elaborate a little bit on that one for Andy?
It's probably not really my question at this point in time. My understanding, it's a bit of both at the moment. It's probably not really my, I'm not, I don't know that someone else here is sitting on some, I'm not sitting on any of those. I will declare my wife is, but it's not for me to comment what's going on those committee. We've had letters saying it's a fair bit of high and some low to be returned. And obviously I was much closer to this when it was first proposed, you know, many moons ago, but at the moment, my understanding, it's proposed that it be returned as high with a little bit of low. I don't know whether Craig or Chris has got the exact numbers on it.
We might need to take that on.
The general understanding, Jeff, it's somewhere slightly above 4 megalitres for every delivery share in the high space and a percentage of low that I'm clearly unsure of, but it's all connected back to delivery share, so it will go back to irrigators to potentially be used on the ground.
Now, we've only got around about 10 minutes or so before we're going to wrap this one up, but it's taken Jeff Turner to raise the question about speculators in the market. We hear regular accusations, says Jeff, that speculators are driving up prices across the Southern Basin. What is the view of the panel to the validity of these accusations? And Peter, you're up first.
Thank you. There are certainly people that trade water for profit. There's no denying that. There's a number of...
Doesn't everybody trade it to make a profit?
Sorry? Well, generally, yeah, some trade to cover cost, but literally the buyers and sellers of water. So there is a handful of people that are recognised that they actually operate in that space as a business function. The market now, I believe, is mature enough and big enough across the entirety of the market that these guys have very little influence on the actual outcomes of the market. And our evidence is basically that they don't. I know there's a lot of talk, and some of it pub talk, that these guys drive the prices. We don't see it. We do not see it.
There's no shortage of pub talk, even when Victoria's undergoing a pandemic, I've noticed. Chris, yeah. You might have a bit more data, a bit more to add on this, the role of so-called speculators. Big deal or not?
Well, the first point I'll make is around language and definitions. Craig and Jeff are speculators. They're speculators on the rain. Every irrigator is speculating on what's going to happen into the future and having to make decisions under uncertainty and risk. So everyone is dealing with an unknown. And anyone who tells you what the price is going to be in the future is kidding themselves unless they can read the weather. So I think there's a definitional point here as well. There are, you know, potentially this small group that Peter talks about who are non-water users who are just involved in trade decisions and trying to make take advantage of arbitrage. Again, I would come back to the point that I made around overall supply and demand is what's dictating what's going on in the market. There are a lot of buyers and sellers, so a handful. It's going to struggle to have an impact, and it'll be interesting to see what the ACCC says in this regard. There's also a group of investors that have purchased entitlement, and they have set up these products that, again, Peter referred to, particularly leases, forwards, that they're providing into the market, which are in demand from irrigators. So there are people out there who want to manage their capital outlay and would prefer to pay the 6% lease on an entitlement. So, you know, if we got rid of them, we'd be reducing options in the market.
Okay, I feel like we could spend a whole 45 minutes, if not more, on the issue of speculators. But David Campbell sent in a question asking about the scope for cooperatives or farmer buying groups in the water market to access certain volumes. For dairy farmers, for example, he's suggesting perhaps that could be something that Dairy Australia might consider, certainly something we haven't seen in the past. Did you want to have a go at that, Chris, or will we handball to Jeff?
I'll handball it to Jeff.
I'm not sure how it would work. I can't speak for Dairy Australia anymore. I wouldn't have thought it was something they would get into. Look, it's all about how do you work out who gets the water. That's the issue. In all those.
Yeah.
And the volumes you would have in, you know, to have any volume, you know, for an industry thing, how do you get a big enough volume to be able to give a return across, you know, to your shareholders? That's the issue.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what problem that would solve.
And what about, we often hear a lot of criticism of the bigger players, of the corporates versus the family farming unit when it comes to having access to irrigation. Certainly we know that this government likes to talk about family farming units as opposed to the corporates. Do you think that there's any space for delineation, like considering those players in the market separately?
I think we might have covered that off with the higher value crop scenario earlier on. A lot of those higher value crop growers are corporates. And it's a similar scenario in the corporate space across the board. I mean, there's corporates in every industry, and I think that just applies. They're just market participants the same as everybody else.
And their challenges are the same as well. They need to understand their own internal business and how to make a profit, and they need to keep an eye on the market both the water market and their other markets, and then they need to make decisions on that basis.
Yeah.
I think that's the important thing. Families, no matter what size their business, can participate in the market at whatever level they want and on what scale, whether it's, you know, in tens of megs, hundreds of megs or thousands of megs. You know, the scale, it's different, but the price is generally the same. You know, we don't have a market where because I want, you know, 2,000 megs, you go to the market and you get it $50 cheaper. That doesn't tend to happen in the water market. If you know, there's a slight adjustment, and that's generally about, as my understanding, it's more about the facility to transfer the water where the little price difference is, but we're not getting significant price difference between the large player and the small player. So, you know, regardless of the scale of our operations, we can operate in the market with the same benefit.
Now, my apologies to all of those who have sent in messages. They're coming in a little bit faster than I've been able to keep up with or that I've been able to put to our panel. But I think Bridget Goulding has a good point here when she asks about the views around transparency in the market, and she points to Mick Kelty's report calling it for it in all aspects of the water market. We know that Mick Kelty found issues with transparency, but also irrigators' access to education about how the water market actually works. And this might be a good place to sort of wrap things up. Just if I could ask each of you to give me your take on how you address these issues around transparency. Beginning with you, Jeff.
There's certain areas that I think we do need a little bit more transparency, but I mean, I don't need everybody to know exactly how I'm operating in the water market all the time. I have no great secrets about it, but I don't need to ring up my water broker and have him click onto my account at the water register and see, well, he's trying to buy water, but he's got this much in his account now and he paid this much for it last week and he sold it for this much the week before and I'm trying to do a deal. I don't deal with that with anybody else I'm doing business with, and we talked about trading in commodities before, and Craig certainly doesn't have to do that with anyone, but he's doing it with commodities. So, yeah, I think there could be some transparency around brokers, that sort of stuff. Perhaps if you wanted some transparency, it's about why people that don't have a water use license can carry water over. You could look at that for example, because they're obviously not going to use it in agriculture. If they haven't got a license, why are they carrying water over? So there's a level, but it's not about everybody being able to click on and see exactly what Jeff Akers is doing with water, what he's buying it for and what he's selling it for. And that's one of the current proposals, and I couldn't support that.
Craig, what about you? Do you think there's a need to know a little bit more about what's going on in the water market?
Not so much at the farm level. Like, what I'd agree with Jeff 100% there. Like, no one opens up their bank account to show them, you know, how much money you have. So why would you do that with water? Probably around the broking industry, there's, you know, it was mentioned about used car salesmen there before, and you know, I'd like to see a little bit more transparency around brokers and, you know, there's brokers that buy and sell water and, there's brokers that broker both sides of the deal. So, you know, around that area there, it would be good to know, you know, if you're actually, the broker's actually buying the water off you, which, you know, you can see sometimes now, but, and I think that can happen. So, you know, a few things around that, but not really.
And Chris Olshak, what's your take on the level of transparency?
Yeah, so look, I completely agree with what Jeff and Craig just said. The other point I would raise there is, and I think what Jeff's saying is, you know, transparency doesn't mean individuals' data is made public. We want transparency about how the market's working overall. And one of the key changes or improvements, which New South Wales has actually just made some steps forward to, is just changing the trade form so that we can have more information in real time about the nature of different allocation trades. There's a lot made around this debate about $0 trades, which are often just people moving water between their own accounts, but the current systems don't allow us to differentiate and understand that something is a $0 trade because it's actually just a transfer between related parties. It would be great to have a bit more reporting as part of those trade forms to know what was the reason for that, to understand, you know, how much is of the trade activity is environmental transfers, to understand a couple of the additional details, like whether it was related to a lease or a forward, and some of these things that will help better analyse what's going on in the market and provide a bit more clarity.
Peter, it's over to you.
Yes, I certainly support what Chris just spoke about in terms of trade types. I think that would provide a great level of transparency and remove some doubt around some of the trade behaviours, particularly at $0 value. You need to justify a $0 value trade. I think that's really important. I can only speak from us as from a broker perspective. We claim to be totally transparent, which we are. Every trade that we've ever done is a matter of record on our website, and we stand on that principle that transparency and ethical behaviour is the cornerstone of our business. We stake our reputation on that, so it's vitally important that the whole of the market has a trust in intermediaries, and if that's what comes out of the ACCC, we certainly welcome that. So
we might all have to check back in once we do get a look at what Mick Keogh's found in terms of the water market. It feels like we've just scraped the tip of the iceberg. I meant to say we should have had a little pun game for every time somebody uses a reference to water, going with the flow, unplugging, dipping a toe, etc. Yeah. I feel like this might have been a good opportunity over the past 45 minutes. But we've also, I think, touched on a lot of themes, and hopefully those listening have found it educational hearing about the way that particularly the farmers are using, the irrigators are using the water market. To Peter, from your experience, and also Chris, who has that policy perspective, I dare say we could very well get the call back to come and have up for the sequel, I hope. With that, Peter Lawford, Craig Reynolds, Chris Olshak and Jeff Akers, thank you for your time. Thanks to the Press Club of Victoria and the Rural Press Club, I should say. If anyone's got an issue with the way this has unfolded, I'm in Canberra, so I know you're at least 2 weeks away from getting me. We'll hand it back to you, Waggy.
Thank you, Kath, and thanks to our panel, and thanks for everyone taking part in our webinar today. As I said earlier, we've got a number of webinars planned for the next few months. We've got two coming up in August, one a panel of international guests on the opportunities and challenges for agriculture globally, which is an early morning start given the different time zones we've got to juggle. And we've got another one also on mental health in rural and regional Australia the following week. So details will be on our website soon. That's actually our new website soon, ruralpressclubvictoria.com.au. In the meantime, stay safe, especially for everyone in Victoria. Thank you and have a great week. Thanks, everyone.
All right.
Thanks.